In the next 20 or 30 odd minutes or so, I'd like to give you information on a concept that has become commonplace in many aero navigation service providers, but not necessarily in the rest of the aviation world, I think. I've decided to keep my jacket off since I'm the one doing the work up here. I hope nobody feels offended. There will be some time for questions afterwards, I sincerely hope. I must take you through a little bit of history first. It started all, as many things, during the war. But this goes back as far as the American Civil War, where traumatic stress was first recognized and is mentioned since then in some literature. It came back later in many accidents where people displayed a certain reaction to things happening to them. And in the early 90s, in America, a certain Jeffrey Mitchell picked it up and used how to deal with critical incident reactions in the American Emergency Services. And he developed the model that is now known as critical incident stress management. And at this moment, we are in the state where we use it in daily operations. First, we've got to understand what a critical incident is. And the exacting factor in this statement is the last sentence. Many things happen to us in many situations. In 95% of the situations, humans are flexible enough to deal with these situations. But sometimes we find ourselves, often surprisingly, not being able to use our normal coping mechanisms, which is very confusing because we don't understand why. And I'm not talking about major incidents or accidents only. It says any event. It doesn't even have to be related to what you do professionally. It can be anything that suddenly wipes you off your feet. It's that coping mechanisms why I did ask Panos, was he offered support after what happened to him? But apparently, his coping mechanisms functioned well, and therefore, what happened? Although I'm sure many of us must have thought, blimey, that's something that must have affected him. Apparently, he has been able to cope with it within his own limits and boundaries, and therefore that has not turned into a critical incident for Panos within this definition. And critical incident stress, then, or traumatic stress, is actually an absolutely normal reaction to an abnormal event, abnormal within the context. There is a difficulty in here, though, because what is normal to me may, almost certainly, is abnormal to you. Or what is abnormal to me today may have been completely normal yesterday. It is very, very subjective, and it is very difficult to put the finger on it precisely. So, how to deal with it? I'm going to ask you to cooperate with me. Those four words, critical incident stress management, I'd like you to think about them and speak them to yourself out loud. Go ahead. Okay, and do it once more and listen to yourself how you actually say them. I think many of you said it this way, critical incident stress management. Am I right? Did you notice that yourself doing it? It's important that we understand that is the natural way of dividing four words into a sentence, but it's in this case not correct. It should be pronounced like this. Critical incident stress management. Why is that important? Well, we do not in this program, address the events. We only address the stress, the reaction of the individual to the event. And therefore, it is important to understand the words that you use to describe that program and to use them correctly. So it's critical incident stress management. I also have to admit that the words critical incident are a little bit tentative. To an air traffic controller, the word incident has a very particular meaning, as well as to a pilot. To a policeman, the word critical has a very particular meaning, which it doesn't have to an air traffic controller or to a pilot. So in air traffic control, this is already a little bit difficult, but we have been using it for so long now, it has become an understanding in its own right that we can't change it anymore. But it is a little bit complicated if you want to take this into other industries. Let me tell you about the program itself. First of all, it is based on confidentiality. When people are going to talk about their traumatic stress reactions, they do not want you to talk about that to third parties. It's based on this confidentiality. Without that, it does not have any chance of success at all. So the people who execute this program, their mouths must be zipped. It is based on peer support. And a peer in this particular sense is somebody who does the same kind of work at the same sort of level, which means that the individual who is bearing their hearts on their sleeve do not have to worry about understanding by the other party, because they are their peers. They don't have to explain what a flight level is or what loss of separation means. That is a known thing, and therefore they can focus on what's them. They see eye to eye. And I do apologize to all academics here. But peers have something that cannot be substituted by any training at all. Another aspect of the CISM program, as we call it, it must be voluntary. The person talking about their stress reactions cannot be forced to talk about it at all. And that is something that not everybody understands completely in our industry. We are confronted on a regular basis where the supervisor sort of wants a controller to go and talk to somebody, because you must be affected considering what has happened to you. But we've seen already, you can't say that about somebody else. We don't know what affects somebody else at all. CISM is not counseling. Those peers who are delivering CISM are trained to use a certain structure to deliver that program. They are not psychologists. They are not necessarily interested in psychology. They only use that program. Related to that is the fact that we do not address the incident itself. We don't go into the background of the incident. We only address the reaction to the incident. We like to call it psychological first aid. What do you do when you cut your finger? Usually, you put a band-aid around it, and that's it. That's usually sufficient to heal the wound, and after a couple of days, you take the band-aid off, and either it has healed or not. It may have deteriorated. In the first case, the band-aid has done its job, and you can leave it as it is. Maybe one more band-aid if it's a bad cut. But if not, if the wound's infested, if it has become worse, then you have to go to seek professional help, medical help in this case. The same thing applies to CISM. Those people, the peers that have been trained to deliver CISM, do nothing but put that band-aid on your soul. And they will come back and talk to you in a couple of days to see whether it has been enough or not. If not, they will help you to find other sorts of support, which may or may not be counseling professionally, depending completely on exactly what the situation is. I'd like to take you now through a couple of stages, a couple of types of critical incident stress interventions that we apply in this program. First, there is the individual intervention. There are a number of group interventions, and there is the crisis management briefing. The individual intervention we call, quite appropriately, a defusing. Because what the defuser does is actually taking the fuse out of a potential explosive situation. Right? By the way, defusing. Not as we quite often see, diffusing, D-I-F-F-using. Why would you want to diffuse an already obscure situation, one wonders? It's usually done within 12 hours. Not limited to that amount of time. If you do a diffusing a little later, it may still be effective, but maybe not as effective as when you manage to do it within those 12 hours. It is peer support, trained peers who know what they're doing, who use a certain structure to help you through that conversation of 20 to 45 minutes, very much depending on how the conversation develops. What's the difference between this and the conversation with a colleague, you may wonder? Because it happens all the time. When something shitty has happened to you, you want to talk about it. You turn towards somebody you know well, a friend, a colleague, if it's work-related. And often enough, that is enough, that is sufficient. And your normal coping mechanisms come back in place and work again. But what if you are in a state where that is not sufficient? The problem then is that you don't know that. Because having talked to that colleague feels good. They understand. They have been in similar situations themselves, because that's what they told you. Oh, don't worry. I've been in that last week. I coped up the same thing the same way last week. It'll be fine. And those are things that soothe our soul. But when you wake up the next morning, nothing has changed. You're still thinking about it. You're still worried about it, because that collegial chat was fine for the moment, but it hasn't changed anything about your own reaction to that critical incident. Those peers are trained to use a certain structure in the conversation where they do address your reaction and where you are given the opportunity to actually change that reaction or learn how to cope with it, to go back to your normal coping strategies as soon as possible. That is the difference. Group intervention, also called a defusing for small groups, is quite similar. Maximum 4 people. Of course, maximum is a bit of a flexible understanding. If a fist comes knocking on the door, you can't say, oi, go away. You let them in. But small, because it's a defusing. It's a similar structure is used as in the individual defusing. And this is, again, the similar amount of time, probably a little longer than the individual diffuser because more people need time to have their say. A large group intervention is the critical incident stress debriefing, which is used after high-impact events. In our industry, the most imminent example is the Speedbird 38 crash 2 years ago at Heathrow. I call it a crash, even though everybody survived, because it was a crash after all, where all air traffic controllers who were working on the tower at that moment had a critical incident stress debriefing afterwards. Also, those people who did not work at that moment, but were the releasing shift, who came on to work afterwards, they were affected as well. And we had a separate critical incident stress debriefing for management because they were affected in their own way. High impact events. Another example was a complete and total power failure in the Scottish centre. And I'm looking to my left here where there's an air traffic controller. If you lose your picture, that's bloody critical. It doesn't make you happy. Had an enormous impact. But not only operational-related incidents. We have been doing this also in situations of bereavements where people are affected in various ways. It has a different structure compared to a diffusing. It is very structural, and you've got to stick to it. You've got to do it not within 12 hours because of the high impact of the event. People need time to first get settled, get used to that it has happened before they are ready to talk about it. Still not counseling, but it is led by peers who have been trained to do this particular kind of crisis intervention, and they are supported by clinical people, by mental health professionals. First of all, to assist those peers themselves, because in high impact events, doing that could easily affect yourself, but also to be available for those people in the group who are being supported that immediately need more support at that moment. That's where the SISM support stops and the professional help begins. It can last anything from 1 to 3 hours. It is highly structured, and we're thinking of groups of a size of approximately 20, 25 people. And the third type of crisis intervention is called a crisis management briefing, which is not necessarily crisis intervention, but actually happens before crisis interventions may become necessary. It has a number of advantages. It does provide information. In many cases, when something has happened, pretty soon afterwards, the rumors start to fly. And what, in many cases, people only need is genuine, reliable information about what has happened for them to cope with it again. The worst thing that can happen is to allow them to let their fantasy fly, because nothing is ever as bad as it is in your own mind. By organizing that, you also demonstrate to people, and we're talking about possibly large groups here, that there is somebody taking the lead, that there is somebody who is paying attention to them. It reduces the sense of chaos if it's really a bad thing. And we all know, I'm sure we all know, that if you don't do anything, staff easily loses their trust in management, and therefore credibility goes out of the window. Rumor control is obvious. If you give genuine information, you take away the need for rumor. If people may be prone to critical incident stress, you already can give them information about where they can turn to or whom they can turn to if that is not known at that moment. And these are obvious. And psychological screening is, in this case, again, if there is a mental health professional present at the crisis management briefing, then they can start gauging people already and see where the possible need may lie. Am I in your way? Allow me to turn to NETS for a moment. NETS, the UK Air Navigation Service provider, simply because I know most about what they do. It's not because they're the best in critical incident stress management in Europe, but I know most about it, which is not a bad thing, being the program manager. And that's we started to implement it in 2004, realizing it's a fast project, a big program, and we have sort of counted on 7 years before it could be established. We're not there yet. We started with ATCOs only. Only controllers. You got to start somewhere. And the program was easiest applicable or being adapted for air traffic controllers. So that's where we started. And in 2006, we added engineers to that group of people who SISM was made for. How do you add people to a group of employees who may suffer from critical incident stress? Well, simply by inviting some of their group to be trained as a peer, because that includes that group immediately, because they have peers available they can turn to. In 2008, those people who introduced CISM in the company in 2004 were awarded for outstanding achievements in the company. This year, we have started to train peers from all sorts of groups in NATS, and therefore we can now say that CISM has been implemented throughout the company, with the exception of managers. Always last, but not least. They have already signed up for training courses to become peer diffusers for next year, which will be exactly the same training, of course. But we do realize that managers have their own critical incidents. If you make decisions that can influence other people's lives tremendously, then you have your own sort of problems with it. Therefore, they need peers to be trained. But those peers will sign the same memorandum of understanding. They will have the same obligation for silence after a diffusing as everybody else. That, by the way, is that award they won in 2008. Let's not discuss the beauty of it. At this moment, these are average numbers, totally average. There are, of course, months when there's more things happening, and when you have one big incident that blows every single average out of the window. But we do approximately 40 individual diffusings per month. We do 2 critical incident stress debriefings, remember the high impact events, per year on average. We have 220 trained diffusers. Those are the ones who deliver the individual crisis intervention. We have 15 interventionists. I still think it's a word I invented, but I'm not sure. Those are the people who deliver the critical incident stress debriefing, that very, very structured, large group intervention. And this is all for a company with 5,000 plus employees, divided over 19 units. And we are still in the development phase. Like I said, we sort of counted on 7 years. We started as being part in the company of safety department, and we're now looking at taking CISM away from safety only, actually, because CISM is more than just safety related. Obviously, when a controller is helped to stop worrying about something very quickly, that will be a more safe controller. That's the theory, at least. I think it might work that way. Does it work, this whole thing? Because it sounds all marvelous and pretty straightforward, but how does one determine whether it works or not? That depends on what you will define as successful. It took not too long a discussion within NATS, but also within the rest of Europe, to come to the conclusion that you can say that CISM is successful when the user, those people who ask for crisis intervention, are satisfied with what they got. And I got 2 quotes for you to demonstrate that. This is based on an incident of 2 weeks ago when a light aircraft ditched in the channel, and those people who were controlling that aircraft did not know what the situation was at that moment with the people in the aircraft. So I'll leave the answer to the question on top to yourself. For some people, this is a more important question. Is it worth it? Coincidentally, lucky for me, because I knew I was going to give this presentation, but I didn't have these numbers until last month, Eurocontrol produced or published a white paper on human performance and ATM safety, in which there was a case study about CISM, and they came up with numbers that I'm going to give to you now. That case study did involve 11 managers. Well, you can read it for yourself. 11 units throughout Europe, 66 incidents in total, of which 48 were treated by some sort of schism intervention afterwards. These incidents, by the way, all involved loss of separation. And that's but one worst situation for an air traffic controller, loss of separation. And these are the results. They all demonstrated reduced emotional stability. They worried about it. They were blown off their feet. But on the left, you see the group of people who did receive schism. It had no negative consequences for the business. And on the right, it did have negative consequences for the business, because when you are worrying about what happened to you, you can't concentrate on the work. Anne has related to that in her presentation about what happens under stress situations. You get tunnel vision. And what does a controller do to protect themselves? They take longer time to make their decisions. They gather more information before they make their decisions. They probably slow down traffic just to give themselves more thinking space. It's all very obvious. Until they are not worried anymore. And in those people who had not a schism treatment, that took about 7 days before their normal coping mechanisms had taken care of the situation. I do not know whether there was one or more controllers who did need other support afterwards. So there were delays of flight and a 10% loss of productivity, which leads to a return of 3.6. And again, I gladly leave the answer to the top question to yourself. SISM has become a standard part of an SMS as a safety program, or not necessarily safety only anymore, in ANSPs worldwide. And I can't see why it wouldn't work in other businesses as well, and not even only aviation related. I was talking during lunch break about train drivers who are the ones sitting in front of the train being very isolated. And if they want to talk about something that happened to them, I'm pretty sure they'd like to talk to somebody who understands how they feel, because they do the same thing. Thank you.